I've spent this week flirting with the idea of owning a Ferrari.
I want them to make something faster than everything else that costs 50 grand less and that I like and that I will buy, and I still won't buy it.
Well, hello and welcome to another edition of the Classics World Chat Show. I'm Phil Whedon, and as ever, I'm joined by my host, Joe Miller.
Hello.
And Jeff Ruggles.
Hello.
Now, for various scheduling reasons, we're not completely hot on the news, and so we won't necessarily dive into the next issue of Classic Car Buyer, mainly because it hasn't gone to press yet. But safe to say, there will be an issue out next Wednesday, so do keep an eye out in the shops for it. But I will, if that's okay, Jeff, grab a little bit of the news spotlight by not talking anything necessarily newsworthy, but of a book I read recently. I actually found this in the local history section of my local library, and it was simply called Turbulent Times in the Car Industry, Memories of a Trade Union Official at Cowley, Oxford, by David Buckle. It's a really basic looking book. For those watching on YouTube, I'm going to just hold up the cover for you so you can have a look. It's a relatively old book as well, but I really enjoyed reading it because, candidly speaking, I was probably, being a child of the 80s, I was probably brought up on a 1980s rhetoric of unions bad, business good type thing. And what this book is really good at positioning is actually all the kind of crazy stuff that some people might associate with unions is dispelled in this book, because David Buckle comes across as a really sensible, moderate union guy doing what unions probably should do well, and that is represent, obviously, the best interests of the workers in those conditions, and talks about very sensible, pragmatic conversations with management, not antagonistic kind of, you know, butting heads type stuff. But one anecdote I'll share with you from the book, which I think just sort of highlights, you know, you hear all these sort of horror stories about the car industry just had these really outdated factories and things. And he was saying at one point they had people working with electrical equipment that were standing in a puddle of water because the factory floor had flooded. So he called time on the working, and technically a 10-minute walkout is still a strike, right? Because it's, you stop working. So he called them all off the line because they just said, look, you've got to mop that up. They can't be wielding these high voltage equipment standing in a puddle of water. It's just ridiculous, which, you know, may only been a very small incident, but if it highlighted the kind of working conditions they were tolerating at that time, you can understand why people were perhaps a bit fed up with that lot, you know, and why modern factories like the one up in Sunderland that Nissan produce cars to this day, with its modern, light, airy kind of conditions, well circulated, clean air, wide corridors, and well delineated kind of places to stand and work and breakout areas and all this sort of thing.
It's interesting to hear about things like that. But yeah, that's not a book that is available at your local newsagent, I wouldn't imagine, but probably worth seeking out, I'd say.
I'm just responding to one of our episodes of the podcast a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about our favourite coupes, because it came up with, there was loads of comments actually, and really thank you very much again at home for getting involved with our buying roundups. It's always good to hear your suggestions, and there were many fabulous suggestions. But one thing that came out of the conversation was that actually defining a coupe is actually not as easy as you think. I think on the one hand, I think Jamie said it in the episode, that coupe has almost become a model name. You know, you just call it almost like you would call it a gear or a tour, like a sport wagon or a tour, you know, it kind of becomes like a tagline. So I thought, just as a bit of fun, these are kind of in age order, because I searched on a popular internet purchase site where you can buy cars of all eras. And I just literally searched by body style. So I did coupe. So you can select coupe. And these cars are all in that bracket.
Are they a coupe or not?
Yes. But I'm going to read through this list, gentlemen, and I want you to tell me whether you think it's a coupe or not.
But let's be as controversial as SUVs. And
I was going to say, if the Nissan Qashqai's on this list, I'm out.
Yeah. There is no SUV on this list, Joe, you'll be pleased to know. Anyway, so all I just need to know is whether you think it's a coupe or not. So a 1964 Chevy Impala.
An Impala?
That's more like one if you want to see it.
Yeah. That's more like a two-door saloon than a coupe.
Yeah, I would go saloon.
Yeah, I'd call that two-door saloon. I wouldn't call that a coupe.
All right.
I don't think the roof is raked enough.
1966 Lotus Cortina.
No. Two-door saloon.
It's a two-door saloon.
This is all fine. I'm not disagreeing with any of this. MGB GT.
Yes.
Yes, coupe.
Some reason I haven't got a picture of that one. That's annoying.
We all know what an MGB GT looks like.
Yeah, we know what an MGB GT looks like. A 1976 Lotus Esprit.
Yes. You kind of don't think of it as an obvious coupe because you just think of it as a sort of sports car, a wedgie sports car, don't you? But it is.
Bang on, Jeff. This is exactly the point, is that some people commented, oh, but it's not a coupe, it's a sports car. And you're thinking, but is a sports car a coupe?
Well, I think a coupe, by definition, has a sporty element to it.
Yeah, this is why I don't think the two-door BMW E30, people call it a coupe, but it's not. It's a two-door saloon.
But did they? I think that got called a saloon, and yet the E36 got called a coupe.
Because that was a coupe. That had like a sloping roofline.
I don't know if we'll get to the E36, but that's kind of one I've always been like a bit like undecided on, because if you think of Corrados and Preludes and things of the time, then it's a saloon, isn't it? It looks like a saloon.
I'm loving this because you're already anticipating what's coming down the list. 83 Alfa Romeo GTV.
Yes.
Yes, coupe. Lovely car as well.
Yes, the year's irrelevant. I don't know why I'm saying the year, but it's just a car I found for sale.
It wasn't a coupe until 83.
Yeah, and the 84 is not a coupe. It's
exactly. A 1986 Toyota Supra.
Yes, coupe.
A BMW E30 3 Series.
Two-door saloon.
It's a saloon, yeah.
People call it a coupe, and that still irks me because it isn't.
So I can't remember which one of you said it, but you're right. The E36 was called a coupe, and it did actually have a different windscreen rake to the saloon.
Yes. And I'd kind of need to sort of study the rear windscreen a bit more to kind of evaluate it. But to me, it's very saloon-like for a coupe. Let's say that.
Okay, chaps. 1990 Porsche 944.
Yeah, coupe.
Yeah.
A 1995 Rover 200 R8 sort of Tomcat.
What model do they call that, Phil?
Well, I've deliberately avoided saying the word, but you're right.
Yeah, it's a coupe.
Yeah, definitely.
A 1995 Saab 900.
Oh.
No, that's a three-door hatch.
Cool. Yeah.
It's a three-door. Yeah. It's not got rear doors.
Yeah, three-door hatch.
Yeah, three-door hatch.
On the earlier 900s, didn't they call it the Combi Coupe?
They did, including the five-door, to be fair.
A 1998 Honda Integra.
Whoa. Technically, it's a hatch. Technically, the Integra's a hatch.
Yeah, but then do you go back to the MGB GT and say that's a hatch? Because it is. I mean, the E-Type was a side-opening hatch, wasn't it, really? So, like, okay, you've got us here, Phil, haven't you, really?
All right, yeah. I see that's a grey area, that one.
I see.
A 1998... Renault Megane.
Coupe.
That's also a hatch, isn't it? But I think it's a coupe for me, as is the Integra.
I think we're in a really grey area with the Megane, but anyway, I still love it, and I love it in that yellow.
But it's called a Megane coupe, so, you know, you can get away with it.
Yeah, exactly. A 1999 BMW Z3 M.
It's called the Z3 M coupe, yes.
That's kind of a car like no other, isn't it? I mean, it's almost a caricature, really. It's not as coupe as the Z4, is it?
No, Z4 coupe is more coupe-ier than that.
One for Jeff here.
Go on. Those of you watching and listening, how do you spell that in the comments?
Yeah.
Coupe-ier.
One for Jeff here, a 2000 Ford Puma.
Without a doubt, yeah.
More emphatically than the Megane, though, I think.
This kind of third door muddies the waters, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because
it does, doesn't it?
I would never call the Saab 900 three-door a coupe.
Yeah.
No, I wouldn't.
No, agreed.
But it
final
kind of
one.
Ticks the boxes of one.
Final one for your list. A 2001 Volvo C70.
Yeah, that's a coupe. But to muddy that water slightly, like I touched on a couple of weeks ago, they call the C30 a coupe. So where do we stand on the C30? Because personally, I call that hatch.
Well, you could go back to this 70s Mercedes, can't you? With the C designation. I mean, is a 123 C123? I mean, it's slopey, but...
I've got in my head that the coupe's got a lower roofline.
It has, I believe.
Yeah,
it's pillarless as well, isn't it? So,
yeah. The one that muddies the waters for me, because do you remember the Mercedes CLS? Now, they call that a coupe on the count of it having swoopy roofline, but it's a four-door saloon. Would you allow the CLS to be called a coupe or not?
Isn't there... sort of some more latter day BMWs that are called coupes.
They do a 6 Series and an 8 Series Grand Coupe, which you get much the same thing. It's a swoopy four door. But again, where do you draw the line? They call the X6 a coupe, but I've got a lot of more colourful language for it.
Our viewers and listeners are smart cookies because they've flagged this very clear anomaly about what constitutes a coupe. Like, is it a swoopy roof line? Is it the fact that it's got a hatchback? Is it the fact that actually it's a two-door saloon? Because some of our choices in that episode were a mixture of the two. And then,
yeah, very true.
I think it was really interesting. It was a debate I hadn't even prepared to have, because I just thought everyone knows what a coupe is, aren't they? But actually, it's not quite clear. Now, we can disagree all day long, but there's clearly what that illustrates is there is a difference in how we define what
I think
coupe.
You could say a couple of those are obviously not coupes. The Lotus Cortina, for instance.
Yeah. Well, again, I said to you last week, Phil, that, or whenever it was, the Volvo 480, I maintain that isn't a coupe. But again, lots of people seem to think it is.
Yeah.
Buying roundups now, chaps.
Yes.
This is a slightly interesting one. I've gone very make specific. I wanted us to all choose a mark and then three cars from their model history that defines that mark. If you wanted to sort of illustrate what best highlights the strengths and the qualities of that mark, you're going to pick three cars that do that. But then just for a bit of fun, I want you to outline what a modern interpretation should look like. No surprise what mark I've gone with. So we'll leave that utter non-suspense to later. So yeah, so go on then. Jeff, your mark and your first defining car.
Right. Well, my mark, I could have started it somewhere else, if I'm honest. It's Ford, but the obvious place to start is with the Model T, but I wanted to start with something else. So I've actually gone with the Mustang, the original Mustang, Mark I Mustang, because that to me was a pioneer in its market. It took the underpinnings from the Ford Falcon and transformed it into a new genre of vehicle that perfectly suited the sort of youth movement of the time. It made a sporty pony car affordable and could be a lot of things to different buyers. So there were different specs that you could afford, and just moved everyone into a new class of vehicle that was sporty and exciting and fun. Not always perhaps the most dynamic, but a really smart looking car that had real curb appeal. And it wasn't just in America, of course, because sort of 5 years later, we got the same with the Capri. And there were so many different variants of the Capri that the man who was used to buying, or lady who was used to buying a Cortina, could step out into something more stylish. And you could have it with anything from a 1.3 litre Kent engine to all the way up to an Essex V6. So again, it was just so versatile. And I think with both cars, you can make a case for them being people's cars. I really do.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
It made Ford desirable with very simple ingredients.
I think it did that Ford thing as well, where, it, like you say, there was something for everyone. And Ford were really on a high in the 60s, particularly with cars like the Mark I Escort, where they could take what was actually in a six-cylinder, guys, a six-cylinder Mustang is not a particularly exciting car, but it made it desirable. And I think, like you say, if you wanted to embody the might of Ford and the intelligence of Ford, that's a very good place to start.
It's the clever marketing that really started to kick in. You know, the clever marketing, the clever packaging, it was the way they managed to combine it into something you wanted that worked so well. And I think the Mustang was probably the first, it was certainly a big milestone in that happening.
Yeah, definitely.
I like it.
So that's what I would get.
Okay, then, Joe, what's your mark and your first defining car?
You won't be surprised to hear mine's Mercedes-Benz. I'm our resident Mercedes enthusiast, and I went with Mercedes, and I think for me, the peak of the brand was when it was in the 70s and into the early 80s, when it made no apologies for being what it was. It didn't try to chase being sporty or being exciting. A Mercedes-Benz was an exquisitely engineered and beautifully built product. And it was, Paul and I joked a while back, that back then Mercedes didn't have accountants. They built the car and then worked out how much they needed to sell it for to make a profit. And it just so happened to cost the same. So that's when Mercedes made no apologies for what it was. They weren't concerned with rivals. The rivals had to keep up with them. And as a result, for me, one of the cars that defines that era is, unsurprisingly, the one I own, the W123. It embodies those principles perfectly. You know, a 280 with all the options would cost the same as a semi-detached house back in 1976. What you got was the most beautifully engineered saloon car, exquisitely finished with so many lovely details. You know, the long travel suspension that meant it could go anywhere, the little bits of chrome down the side that kept spray from going up the windows when it rained, and the rid lights that meant they didn't get dirty in the snow and whatever, so you could still see them. The door that shuts like a bank vault, and all the interior trim that was so beautifully finished, and again, is still rock solid 50 years later. And the fact it was somehow classy and yet classless. You could put a 123 in front of a stately home, or you could have it as a 500,000-mile raggedy example being a taxi in Africa, and it doesn't look out of place anywhere. And Mercedes don't do that anymore. They don't make a car that works everywhere. And that's one of the reasons why I love them. I think that was Mercedes showing what they thought a car should be. And for me, that made it one of, if not the best car in the world at the time.
Very good. Very good. Well, my mark of choice is Allard. No, I'm joking. It's Jaguar, obviously. But, and actually, it's interesting, Jeff, you talking about Ford and some extent you, Joe, talking about Mercedes, because they do almost have so many cars that probably epitomize what they did best about either accessible cars for the masses, and but done well. You know, they weren't compromised. They weren't just a bunch of marketing slides. And Jaguar's in a little bit of the same boat, although regrettably, the cars I've chosen tend to be much earlier in their back catalogue. So the first car I've gone with is the E-Type, and I probably could have gone with XK120 almost interchangeably in terms of how it kind of grabbed the world's attention because it was so achingly gorgeous and it looked quite futuristic for its day. Swoopy sports car shape that could show a clean set of heels to a Ferrari, but it crucially, and this is the bit that I really think is important because it will determine what I talk about later, is it was significantly cheaper than that Ferrari that you might have had it instead. So it was as desirable and as sporty, arguably, but a lot cheaper. The E-Type for me is that kind of starting point of a car that probably most people would think of if they think Jaguar.
Not to overuse the word, but it is iconic.
To bring us back down to earth, let's revert to Fords, Jeff. Your second defining Ford.
My second Ford. Wow. It's not car. It's a van. And of course, it's a Ford Transit. 61 years old this year. The impact of the Transit was massive because arguably it was the first van that handled and drove like a car. And it was hugely versatile as well. I mean, even at launch, there were 78 submodels. Such was its impact and its sales success that, you know, Transit has become the generic term for mid-sized van, really, hasn't it? Ford themselves, you know, labeled it the backbone of Britain. And I think it's true. I mean, it's still with us now. I mean, admittedly, the new one shares its platform with the T7 Volkswagen. But actually, if you look at it from the back, there are definitely echoes of that Mark I styling still there. Now, Transit is just street furniture, and it has been for over 60 years. There's no denying it changed the van game, and it's still so important now. It's their best-selling vehicle in Europe. It's just everywhere. I mean, everyone's got a memory of a Transit, I think.
It even falls into that vernacular of sort of Transit man or whatever, you know. It's just, you don't, no one says Bedford CF man.
No.
They will say Transit man.
I think is another way it kind of embodies that Ford engineering. Well, like you say, there's nothing about it was groundbreaking. It took sort of established ingredients that already existed, but just put them into a format that was head and shoulders above the competition.
I mean, it was wider than traditional vans. It was styled properly. It used car-based engines. A tradesman didn't have to have an agricultural vehicle. It would sit on the motorway, if you were so inclined, at above the speed limit.
Entirely hypothetically, of course.
Entirely hypothetically. And, you know, 8 million of them have been made. So that tells its own story.
Extraordinary, isn't it? Yeah. Really good choice.
They still haven't got on top of their rust proofing, but that's just Ford's for you.
Yeah. Joe, your next defining Mercedes.
Yes. So when you ask Mercedes, obviously the defining car of the brand, I think, or the model of the brand, is the S-Class. It's long been the flagship luxury limousine. It's the standard to which every other car maker, Rolls-Royce, Bentley, Range Rover, have to measure themselves. And there's the old adage that if you want to know what tech your car's going to have in 10 years' time, look on the latest S-Class. And for me, the ultimate generation of S-Class is the W126, introduced in 1979. And it, being an S-Class, it brought all kinds of innovations. First standard driver's airbag, first standard seatbelt retentioner. They had offered double glazing for the first time, and it's certainly a European car. Massive advances in safety with crumple zones and side impact bars and so on. The fact they sold nearly 900,000 of the things, and this isn't a cheap and cheerful people's car. This was a luxury limousine that cost as much as a house. A massive variety of variants from six cylinders up to big V8s. Obviously, the SEC just added further glamour and class. The ultimate luxury car in terms of it took the 1-2-3 principles and just scaled them up. So it's built like a tank. It's classy, it's classless. It doesn't really shout about itself like a Bentley or a Rolls does. It can very much slip away into the background, but inside you're enjoying the ultimate in luxury. For me, the luxury shouldn't shout about itself. And I think the 126 S-Class does that perfectly. Again, fabulous car and still one of the brand's best.
Yeah, lovely. Yeah, really good choice. I highly approve. My second choice, I think you'll also approve actually, Joe, because it's the Jaguar XJ6 Series 1.
Oh.
And it is specifically the Series 1 because, again, and much like the E-Type, I think it was so, people use the word game-changing quite a lot, I know, but I think the fact that it replaced a whole slightly confusing plethora of Jaguar saloons in one fell swoop, beautiful, elegant, graceful looking saloon, but it had a sporting edge to it. It looked nothing like anything else, really. And I think to drive, its ride and handling was better than anything else, either cheaper or more expensive. So it was a proper kind of seminal car in that, at that period in 1968. And least of all that we forget, it probably marks the sort of the last chance that Jaguar really could make a statement. And obviously after that, Jaguar then falls into the clutches of the British car industry's own travails on a wider sense. XJ6 Series 1, just for me, epitomises that punching above its weight that Jaguar could do so well in the 50s and 60s.
I couldn't have said it better. I think it's a wonderful car. And again, like you say, how capable it was for how much it cost. It was less. It was like a third the price of a Silver Shadow. Yeah, epic car. And I think you could probably add the XJ6 Series 1 to that small list of cars that everyone on the Classics World team likes. I think we all like the XJ6 Series 1.
Yeah.
And for good reason. Yeah, wonderful choice.
So what we'll do now, we're going to go on to the final choice. But then, Jeff, you can segue into your kind of vision of the future. Now, it's worth saying that certainly when I did it for my Jaguar future vision, I've had to make no considerations to profit and loss accounts, government legislation.
My Jaguar don't do that anyway, do they?
Any marketing worries or anything. This is just purely a personal shoot from the hip about what I'd like to see Jaguar do. But anyway, Jeff, your final choice, and then straight on to your dream future Ford.
You guys have been quite highbrow in your choices. So my third choice, again, is very humble. And it's the Ford Fiesta.
Lovely.
Of course.
50 years old this year, of course. I own one of the very first examples. The main thing about the Fiesta is it was a change of tack from Ford. It was a huge investment into a new production facility. It was its first front-wheel drive transverse engine car. And it was clean sheet, really, because it was roomier inside than the Mark II Escort. It was neatly styled. I mean, Ford were quite late to the Super Mini game, but they really, really nailed it straight away. Nice slick gear change. It was like a proper car scaled down. And it's no surprise that within 2 years, it was Europe's best-selling Super Mini, and it sold 1 million by 1980. And that basically continued. The Mark III shot it to the top of the sales charts in 1990. And then I think apart from the Corsa in 2009, it was the bestseller for 12 years straight. If you go by last year's figures, it's still the UK's best-selling used car. So we love the Fiesta. And those early cars, obviously groundbreaking. Even the early ones with no sporty pretensions, really, were great. But then they sort of added the sporty ingredients and the marketing to make you want one. And perhaps the marketing kind of carried the Fiesta through the 80s and the 90s a little bit, when it was no longer really quite as class-leading and groundbreaking as it initially was. But then when you've got the Mark 7, the Mark 8, genuinely fantastic class leaders again. And so for Ford to drop it in 2023 was just kind of a bizarre move for me, especially with the Corsa still on the market. So the Fiesta exemplified what Ford was good at, you know, especially in the marketing terms. You wanted one. People wanted an XR2. People wanted a later ST, perhaps. I don't think Ford has that desirability that I want one of its cars now. And the Fiesta was kind of everything to a lot of people, and the same for the Focus. So with what I want from Ford now is a car that I want. You know, I don't want a repurposed VW. I want an exciting class-leading Super Mini again.
Isn't there rumours they are going to bring the Fiesta back somehow?
Yes, with it's going to be Renault 5-based thing. Yeah. But the kind of the fun thing about the late Fiestas, especially, is that they stood alone as being cleverly engineered. And they drove really nicely. You don't want something repurposed. I want a Ford product that does what those did.
Well, it's
you're only
SUVs,
talking 5 years
it?
Ago that they were making these cars.
Yeah. And it is a shame. You're absolutely right. Are you saying that they don't want a sort of slightly awkward 3 or 2.5 box saloon design that's all electric and then you call it a Capri? You're saying they don't want that?
Well, when was the last time you saw one?
Yeah, anyway.
Have you ever seen
Joe, you're keeping my mouth very firmly closed on that one.
Probably wise. Joe, your final Mercedes choice, and then what Mercedes should be doing next.
So obviously we've talked about with Mercedes the engineering and the solidity and the lack of chasing sportiness, because that's not what the brand is about. And you could embody that also perfectly in the R107 SL. Obviously the SL, longest produced model for the brand apart from the G-Wagen. And the R107 was perhaps when it reached its peak, this glamorous, stylish, long-legged GT car that appealed to everyone from driving through the center of London to being in Dallas and all these other glamorous American teams. You know, it was in Knight Rider, as we've touched on, things like that. It's still a gorgeous thing. It still turns heads. You could still drive one through Monaco and probably turn more heads than a Lamborghini. Built like a tank, wonderful to drive. No concessions to sportiness whatsoever. It's a long-legged cruiser, plain and simple, built impeccably, and a fabulous car. And the only thing I dislike about the R107 is that I can no longer afford one. To show Mercedes doing its own thing and not trying to compete with BMW, not trying to be sporty, not trying to be Porsche, the R107 does it perfectly, and they're just wonderful. That was the brand being itself. Before, the R129 was a great car that came afterwards, but it made some concessions to sportiness that arguably took it away from core Mercedes in my eyes.
I utterly agree. It's quite telling that your three Mercedes choices are all from the same era, pretty much.
Yeah, quite right. Not to mention that'd be a good three-car garage, but anyway.
Yeah.
So that kind of brings me on. My vision for a modern Mercedes is I think the brand needs to find its identity again. Stop with all this jelly mold saloons and the SUVs and the electrics, and stop trying to be a sporty, dynamic package. Leave that to BMW. That's not what Mercedes was ever about. It needs to do a big luxury saloon, not an E-Class or an S-Class, but get rid of the 27-inch rims and get rid of the AMG packages and get rid of all the Nürburgring lap times. Just make a big, solidly built executive car with wheels that are fitted but not enormous, a bit of ride comfort, a little bit of wallow, because what's wrong with a bit of body roll in a saloon car? I'm not trying to go around the Nürburgring every day in the thing. Just make it solidly built, well-engineered, and a technical pioneer, because that's what Mercedes was always about. And even their sense of style has kind of gone south. I mean, a neighbor of mine has got a new C-Class, and it looks like the previous generation that's melted. You look at a 123, for example, and it fits its proportions. It's neat, and it's a big car, but it looks like it's shrunk onto itself. It's neat and tight and well-proportioned. It looks like the new one. They've almost made a clay model that's then slightly melted. They've lost it. They've lost their identity in my eyes.
So my final Jaguar choice is the XJS. Now, we talked about the XJS before, and actually it had a 21-year production life in the end, and its first 6 or 7 years were rather unremarkable, in fact, positively disappointing. And it really did only come of age after the HEV 12 and the 3.6 AJ6 came out. But I think the bit I want to celebrate with the XJS in particular was its bravery when it came out. In 1975, it was brave. I think everyone was sort of expecting probably a pastiche of the E-Type, a slightly evolved version of it. But no, they just tore the rule book up and started over and said, this is what people want. And although for other factors, it wasn't a commercial success from the get-go. At least they shifted over 90,000 of them or something like that. And throughout the 80s, it became kind of the archetypal luxury sporting grand tourer. And nothing really looks like it before, since.
It's a classic Jaguar story of it. By the end of its life, it was the car it should have been at the beginning. It was constant evolution.
Exactly. Now, I've been playing with AI, I'm afraid. I've got a few future versions of Jaguars. None of these images are real, and it probably wouldn't pass a single crash test in 2026, but I'm going to share them with you anyway. So this is not very helpful if you're listening to the podcast, but anyway, this is a modern day interpretation of an E-Type.
Ooh, I rather like that.
That looks a bit like an X100 with a body kit on to me, sorry.
Exactly. I can tell you now, the bonnet line wouldn't pass muster for modern pedestrian crash safety, but I just want them to make another E-Type. And I know someone's going to say, yeah, but they made the F-Type. Well, they did, but the problem is with the things like the F-Type and even the XK and X150 version is that they look great, but they didn't have that same, what you mean, that's got the same performance as a Ferrari F430, but is like 50 grand cheaper, because I don't think it was, certainly when you get to sort of the real posh stuff. I then asked it to redesign the XJ for me. So there we go.
Oh, again. Like rather like that.
It's not hideous. I then asked it to do a coupe version.
Yeah, I actually quite like that. But the front end is not working for me, I'm afraid.
Basically, in essence, as well as doing a sports car, a la E-Type, that's like got Porsche 911 GT3 performance, but it's about 50 grand cheaper. I want them to do a big saloon that you can do a short wheelbase, a long wheelbase, a two-door coupe version, because why not? XJC, love it. I then want you to take the roof off and turn it into a four-seater convertible.
Yep, I'm down for that.
Then here's this for a bit of a radical thing. I said, what if Jaguar did an MPV, like a seven-seater? I was driving past Silverstone just before the British Grand Prix, and the A43 was awash with Mercedes Vito van, blacked out windows, carrying all the drivers and the end, like the top end and principals and stuff. And they were all driving these posh Mercedes seven seaters. And I sort of think, why shouldn't Jaguar do a MPV seven seater? The whole grace, pace, space thing.
Why not?
So introducing the new Jaguar People Mover.
Did a Ford Galaxy crash into the back of it?
Well, you joke. I said, I want Jaguar to do a people mover. It's got to have seven seats, so but it's got to have sleek styling. So think Ford S-Max and a Jaguar XJ. And that's
so
what it is.
That literally.
I think it has just grafted an S-Max onto the back of it. So I would say the styling needs work, but as a principle, I think it could all be based on the same platform as well. I want this to just be one platform that makes that seven-seater, the four-seater convertible, the two-door coupe, the saloon in short wheelbase and long wheelbase, and then that's all your kind of luxury base and pace space thing, and then you've got your archetypal halo sports car that could just steadily evolve and do ever crazy versions, and that's what I need Jaguar to do, please, if you don't mind. I have absolutely no idea what the economics of such a model plan would be, and I'm sure there's people within Jaguar barking at me going, you absolute moron.
We should just clarify, we're very quick to have opinions. We have no idea what we're talking about.
It's probably quite hard running a car company in 2026, so we won't judge too much.
I want them to make something faster than everything else that costs 50 grand less and that I like and that I will buy, and I still won't buy it.
Yes, the economics are all there. I want it on finance for £199 a month with no deposit and free insurance. But anyway, what are we up to in the near future, chaps? Jeff, what about you?
Well, it's Festival of the Unexceptional, isn't it? Well, hey, up at Grimsthorpe Castle. So got to work out
which unexceptional vehicle
or Mini 850 City.
Yeah, you took the Fiesta last time, didn't you?
I did, but quite frankly, the idea of driving an 848cc Mini with 34 horsepower to Lincolnshire is going to be quite hard work. So we'll see. But I have no doubt it would make it. And actually, the lady used to go to Lincolnshire in it all the time. I don't know yet. I'll have a think on that.
Very good. I think we're all going to hopefully step up to Festival of the Unexceptional. I've not been for a couple of years, and I really want to get back there and
likewise
see some of the oddities up there. What about you, Joe?
Well, they're coming thick and fast now. By the time you see this, well, actually, no, I won't be. But this weekend, I'm going to Brands Hatch for the British Superbikes because they after a bit of a hiatus, we're back. Went to Snetterton last week. It was fabulous. The weather held. We had three great races. Absolutely loved it. Lap records broken across the board. So that was brilliant. Yeah, this coming weekend, as you listen to this, we're back at Brands Hatch, which is my homecoming track because it's less than an hour from me. So I don't have to slip half out the country for it. Always love it. Brands Hatch, if you've never been, go. Because there's no atmosphere like Brands Hatch on a race day.
Really pretty circuit. I mean, I think Alton Park is up there as well. But Brands Hatch is a lovely, pretty circuit.
I've watched a little sort of behind-the-scenes thing with Stuart Higgs, who's the race director for British Superbikes, and he said that BSD at Brands is good for the soul. It just feels very complete experience. And honestly, yeah, I couldn't disagree. Brands has been the site of a few great BSB races, that legendary one in 2024, which again, go and watch it online if you haven't. It was amazing.
Yes,
and
I remember you said that.
The championship is closing up after a few exciting races at Snetterton. So yes, I won't dive too far into it, but Kyle Ryan's victory may not be as certain as I thought it was. So stay tuned.
Well, very good. Well, look, this coming Sunday is the Bromley Pageant of Motoring. We gave it a plug last week, but we'll give it one final plug. We'll be there as part of Classics World. I'll be at the South of England Showground at Ardingly Lyon this coming Sunday, the 19th. There'll be thousands of beautiful classic cars of all eras and styles, and I'll be in the arena in the afternoon interviewing some owners and I think a bit of prize giving about 3:30. So very much looking forward to that. And then the week after, I think hopefully I'll be joining Jeff and Joe for the Festival of the Unexceptional. So very much looking forward to that. Lots of stuff coming up in August as well. We've got two events of our own on the same weekend. That's how busy it is. We've got our Classic and Retro Revival back at Tatton Park on the weekend of the 15th and 16th of August. But we've also got our Tracks event at Silverstone, which is always a memorable event. It's almost 30 years old, that event now, but we're going to be celebrating the hot hatch because of 50 years of the Golf GTI, of course. So I'm looking forward to that in particular because I think that's going to be rather special. And we're running quite long today. I do apologize. Maybe that coupe debate ran on a bit. But let's quickly get on to our want of the week. Jeff?
You may remember last week I mentioned a mini event some friends had staged the previous week. And as part of that, quite a lot of people turned up in mini mokes.
Wow.
Which for the weather at the time, the weather we're having, it's just the ultimate summer fun car, isn't it? So they went off on their own little separate run. I think they're probably at least 15 of them. And now I want one. They're not cheap. There's a couple coming up at auction, actually. In fact, Anthony Hamilton's example is going up for auction with Iconic.
How much can one pay for a mini moke these days?
Well, that one I think is estimated something like 25 to 30 grand.
Wow.
But it is a very good one. One family owned for 57 years. But a friend of mine has got a slightly ratty one for sale that he's keen to move on. And yeah, I'm sort of fighting the urge, really. I probably get used to about 3 days a year, but, you know, still want one.
What about your wants of the week, Joe?
On a similar theme, retro British styled, albeit reliable and no less rusty. I've touched base with an old flame of mine, a car I've wanted to own for years, the Nissan Figaro. I saw one locally and I went, oh, but like on a summer's day, roof down, they're not fast, but they're charming and they're lovely. And I drove one for a few video for the channel quite a few years ago now, and I just loved it. And I ended up looking at them for sale. There you go. There's one.
I'll just confirm, you did say no less rusty, didn't you?
No less rusty. No, they rust just as much as minis do.
Yeah.
This one isn't rusty. It's £5,000, 54,000 miles. And most importantly, it's got cold air conditioning, which at the moment will be very important.
They have been £5,000 since the beginning of time, haven't they?
Yes, they have. Yes. It's one of those cars that will forever be £5,000, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, I love Figaros. They're not fast. They're not sporty, but they're a lovely baby cruiser. They're sort of like a 1/4 scale R107, if you like. Just boaty and soft and not sporty, but charming. And yeah, I could quite fancy one.
That's a very good choice. Right at the other end of the scale, I've spent this week flirting with the idea of owning a Ferrari.
Blimey, well, some of us are better paid than others.
I say flirting with the idea because I could never afford one, let alone drive one or maintain one.
He's got to get it in there, hasn't he?
Yeah. Just sometimes you go, what would it be like? You know, how cheap can I get a Ferrari and what would it look like? Well,
it would look like an MR2 with a body kit.
Yeah, well, that's probably the cheapest way of doing it, right? But anyway, so I started looking around, did the whole thing, went online, find me a Ferrari, sort by cheapest first. And then this one comes up. It's a 1990 Ferrari Mondiale.
Convertible.
Convertible one for £34,000. It's still more money than I'd want to pay. And I think that wouldn't be the end of your bills, unfortunately.
No.
Because, you know, anything with a Ferrari's probably got a high price ticket in terms of maintaining it and fixing
its
various...
Isn't that a 4-seater mid-engine convertible?
It's not horrendous, is it, that 30-odd grand? I mean, what's a VW ID3 these days? It must be around...
This is it. It's a proper pucker Ferrari, mid-engine V8. If you're unsure about what it'd be like to own one, Phil, I can encourage you to go and watch the Living with a Ferrari Mondiale video on the channel.
Very good plug, indeed. Yes, and that guy was a legend. I think
Colin, absolute. We're going to film it again with him very soon. Yeah, absolute legend.
So there we go. I can always dream, I suppose. One day I'll channel my inner Tom
in a Ferrari Selleck. Cap and a Ferrari jacket with Ferrari shoes and Ferrari gloves and Ferrari sunglasses.
Just pretend, even if I would just turn up in my company Volkswagen. But anyway, there we go. Look, thank you very much, chaps. That was a good catch up. I particularly liked our little coupe debate. That was worth it. Viewers and listeners, as ever, thank you very much for your time. We do appreciate you getting involved. We love reading the comments on the YouTube channel. And if you are watching on YouTube, give us a like and a subscribe, ring that notification bell and get stuck in, get involved in the comments. Let us know, what do you think makes a coupe? And what mark of choice would you do? What should Jaguar, Mercedes or Ford make that would make you want to buy it? If you're listening on a podcast platform, give us a rating, give us a review and spread the word. We love to sort of share our ramblings with the rest of the classic car community. So the more the merrier. But in the meantime, Jeff, thank you very much. Joe, appreciate it. For you guys at home, we'll catch you again next time. Bye.
Bye-bye.